From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Immigration reform, a push from the right. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. A so-called conservative fly-in of 600 corporate executives, police chiefs, farmers, and evangelicals landed on Capitol Hill today. They're smaller in number than the crowds of immigration advocates who've appeared on the Washington Mall, but this time some Republicans might be listening. About 80 GOP members may need the support of Latino voters badly enough to agree to some form of legalization and citizenship. Does this leadership lobby have the clout to get immigration reform moving again? Does it have the backing of its own grassroots members? Today's talking point, U.S. troops in pursuit of the Lord's Resistance Army in Congo. First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Alney back with To the Point. A coalition of 500 or 600 conservatives is on Capitol Hill today to lobby Republicans for immigration reform. They range from the Chamber of Commerce to evangelicals who have been praying for reform, which they say does not mean amnesty. Can they move enough GOP members to get House leaders to allow a vote on a bipartisan measure? Today's talking point, a firsthand account of American Special Forces hunting for warlord Joseph Kony in the jungles of Congo. First, this news update. President Obama has tried to distance himself from American spying on foreign leaders. Now, U.S. intelligence officers are pushing back. They claim the White House and the State Department signed off on the targeting of phone conversations by friendly foreign leaders. That's according to Ken Delanian, who is a national security correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Ken, good to have you on our program.
Good to be with you, Warren. Thanks.
What are these intelligence officials telling you?
Well, they're saying that it's inconceivable that senior people in the White House were not aware that friendly ally leaders were being eavesdropped on, even if the president personally wasn't briefed on every single one of these operations. They say that wouldn't necessarily happen, but certainly people in the National Security Council and senior officials in the White House would have been aware, and there would have been intelligence products that would have made it clear that these phone conversations were being monitored.
You say that they're concerned that the president is somehow casting them adrift?
Yeah, they feel like everything they did was pursuant to, you know, U.S. law and an intelligence priority system that emanates from the White House. I mean, the president is their customer, their ultimate customer, right? So now he's saying, I didn't know, and maybe we should reconsider this. Well, two things. One, I didn't know, which they find hard to imagine. And two, they don't think that we should stop spying on allies who are sometimes adversaries like France and Germany. I mean, France spies on the U.S. extensively and does economic spying and so forth.
Well, now the president has called for a review, and officials are testifying before Congress. James Clapper, the director of intelligence today, said that we only work within the law. Here's more of what he had to say to the House Intelligence Committee.
The disclosures, for better or for worse, have lowered the threshold for discussing these matters in public. So to the degree that we can discuss them, we will. But this public discussion should be based on an accurate understanding of the intelligence community, who we are, what we do, and how we're overseen. In the last few months, the manner in which our activities have been characterized has often been incomplete, inaccurate, or misleading, or some combination thereof.
And here's President Obama speaking with a reporter at the Fusion Network.
I am initiating now a review to make sure that what they're able to do doesn't necessarily mean what they should be doing.
Ken Delanian, back to you with the Los Angeles Times. So what is the nature of this review? And other than the president, who else is calling for it?
Oh, actually, some very senior lawmakers, including Dianne Feinstein, who chairs the Senate Intelligence Committee, and John McCain on the Republican side, are both calling for an extensive review of various U.S. surveillance programs. I think the bottom line is here is this stuff was fine until the NSA got caught, and now it's sort of indefensible to be spying on close allies, even though, you know, privately intelligence officials say it's a good idea. So the politicians sort of have to say, look, this is we need to take a look at this, and maybe in the end there'll be some agreement to, not to spy on friendly leaders, and the question will be whether it's actually honored.
Now we have a bipartisan bill being introduced by Democrat Patrick Leahy in the Senate, and on the House side, Jim Sensenbrenner, who, of course, was the author of the Patriot Act. What is this new one?
Right. Now, this is about U.S. Phone records, you know, the NSA's program that gathers up metadata, not content, but, you know, the, who is called, the numbers called, in a big old database, and that's for counterterrorism purposes. So that bill would end that practice. Now, that's where, like, the Dianne Feinsteins of the world and the Intelligence Committee, that they are against ending the practice. They support continuing to collect these records because they say it's important to connect the dots and terrorist plots. And for that reason, it's not clear that this bill is going anywhere. But at some point in a couple of years, that law will have to be affirmatively reauthorized, in which case it'll be a lot harder for proponents to get it passed in exactly the form it's in now.
Back to the spying on foreign leaders, I understand the people you talk to say it's the State Department that's always involved in this. And so do they, is this your understanding that they tell the NSA what to do?
Well, not exactly that, but what they say is that, like, for example, the U.S. ambassador in a particular country would be looped in and would have an interest in learning intelligence about what that country's leader is saying, I don't know, a diplomatic negotiation or a UN matter. And that certainly the State Department also assesses targets for political risk. So they get a voice in, hey, is this intelligence operation a good idea? But it's also probably true that the NSA, you know, a lot of these programs started years ago and could be on autopilot and are not maybe regularly briefed to senior people. So probably only people at the highest levels of the NSA and a few people in the White House knew exactly what was going on.
So the NSA got caught, as you pointed out, and now we have a foreign delegation in Washington trying to work out some sort of arrangement whereby the countries can continue to trust each other.
Right. But, and the latest revelation is that these stories about the NSA gathering millions of phone records in France and Spain was actually the French and Spanish intelligence services turning it over to NSA. So that's going to upend what people thought they understood about where this story was going.
Okay. Well, as we heard James Clapper said, maybe we all better try to understand exactly what is going on. Thanks for your report to Ken Delaney, and again, the national security correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Always good to have you on our program.
Good to be with you, Warren. Thanks.
In a moment, immigration reform, a push from the right on To the Point.
Check out our new YouTube video channel, The Q. KCRW DJs curate themed video playlists and feature artist clips straight from YouTube. Add some visual to your audio. Explore now at kcrw.com/theq.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
We're on Alney back with To the Point. A group of high-profile conservatives from around the country rallied today at the Chamber of Commerce office in Washington before business and law enforcement leaders and farmers and evangelicals descended on Capitol Hill. They heard this from Grover Norquist. He's the influential leader of the Americans for Tax Reform. Quote, "We will be the dominant power of the future because we'll do immigration better than other countries." And he added this, "This is not an issue unraveling. This is an issue coming together." Alan Gomez reports on immigration for USA Today. Good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
It has certainly looked to everybody else as if it was an issue that was unraveling. The Senate passed a bill. The House has had nothing whatsoever to do with it. Does there appear to be some progress after all?
Well, depends who you ask, right? This right now, we got kind of a tattered situation in the House. They're going there. There's a few different avenues that they're following right now, but it's starting to look like there could be some momentum here towards the end of the year.
They have two members of Congress now who have said they would support a bipartisan bill. One of them is Elena Ross Layton of Florida. The other is Jeff Denham of California. How important is that?
Well, that's been pretty remarkable. I mean, it's now a bipartisan bill. When this thing was filed a few weeks ago, it was basically just the Democratic version of an immigration bill in the House. It was the chief sponsor on the bill is Joe Garcia from Florida, but it had the endorsement of Nancy Pelosi. It's picked up about 180 Democratic co-sponsors, but in a Republican-led House, that obviously doesn't amount to too much. But what we've seen over the last few days is at least these first couple of Republicans signing on board. We're starting to see, hear rumblings that there might be some other Republicans that decide to co-sponsor this bill. And that suddenly starts becoming somewhat important because, as we've seen with some other votes in the recent past, most recently with the vote to end the government shutdown, the House has not completely ruled out the idea of allowing Democrats and a handful of Republicans to pass legislation. So that's kind of the push that they're starting on that side of things right now. So, when you figure if you already got 180 Democratic co-sponsors, you only need a few dozen Republicans to jump on board before you get to that magic 218 to pass something in the House. So it's starting to look like there might be something there.
Don't we have the Hastert rule, though, as we heard about with the budget and other issues as well, whereby you only allow something to come to the floor if you're the Republican speaker, if you have a majority of your own caucus?
And that's absolutely right. That's still there. But as these Democrats were quick to point out, there have been several instances over the last year where they have ignored the Hastert rule. When you look at the vote on the Violence Against Women Act, that's how they got that done. When you look at the vote when they passed the emergency aid for Superstorm Sandy that hit the Northeast, that's how they got that done. And to end the government shutdown, they did the same thing there. So they're saying this should be just the latest example of violating or just kind of ignoring that rule.
Tell us some of the people who are part now of this 500 or 600 person delegation, which met today at the Chamber of Commerce before they started going around to Republican offices on Capitol Hill.
Well, that's been an interesting development over the last year. I mean, back the last time immigration reform, they attempted it. It was a lot of work from immigration advocacy groups that were trying to get this thing pushed to get that thing passed back then. But this time, it's been this very organized effort. They did this earlier in the year where they brought in pastors, as you were mentioning, pastors, law enforcement agents, sheriffs, police chiefs, things like that, business owners. And it had some effect over in the Senate. And that was it. They were able to help get that thing through. So now they're trying to do the same strategy over here. There was over 600 of them. I spoke with quite a few of them, and then these are just like you're explaining. I mean, just kind of regular pastors. I talked to a small business owner from Tampa, Florida, and he works for a high-tech company, and he was explaining to me that he's not really all that political, but he decided to come on this because he's pretty much tapped out. He's got, he has room to grow. He can expand. The sales opportunities are there. They develop software at this company. But he said he just can't find enough high-tech, enough workers trained in computer programming to hire. He said he could hire 10, 15 more tomorrow if the legal immigration system were reformed. So these folks think that they can speak a little bit more directly to those House conservatives than maybe like a very liberal group or just traditionally immigration advocacy group. They think they can speak a little more directly to them. I mean, it's one thing to say no to the National Council of La Raza if you're a Republican House member, but it's quite another thing to say no to your pastor. So that's the strategy they've been employing, and they'll be there all day today meeting with those conservative members.
And there's high tech, and there's also on the other end farmers who are under the economic scale, farmers who are interested in this as well. Let me introduce Galen Carey. He's Vice President of Government Relations at the National Evangelical Association. Mr. Carey, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
Tell us, if you will, what stake evangelicals have in immigration reform.
Well, evangelicals care about immigration reform because we know that God loves immigrants and instructs us in the Bible that we should also be welcoming to immigrants. So we've had people for the last year reading verses from the Bible. We have a I Was a Stranger challenge where people read a verse a day for 40 days from the Bible, and then they pray over that and allow God's word to speak to their hearts and minds. And that has really influenced the way a lot of our members have come to think about the topic.
Is there one or more references that you use from the Bible?
Oh, there are many. The Hebrew word for immigrant appears in the Old Testament 92 times, and there are passages throughout the New Testament. You can't open the Bible without finding people who are migrants moving from place to place. Abraham, the father of the Jewish faith and very important to Christians, was a migrant 3 times. So we see that in the Bible, and then we also see Jesus, who himself was a refugee in Egypt. we see him saying, I was a stranger and you welcomed me, and we take our cues from that.
Okay, so it is in the Bible then that we ought to be kind to immigrants. Back to Alan Gomez with USA Today. There are some others who are part of this group that don't seem to fit with the conservative mode. One of them is Mark Zuckerberg, the founder of Facebook, and there's also money behind it from George Soros, the wealthy backer of many liberal causes.
Yeah, I mean, that's the interesting thing about this coalition that they've been able to form, pushing for this, is, you know, folks who would traditionally not be, you know, on the side of maybe an immigration advocacy group. I know Zuckerberg and a lot of these sort of companies out of Silicon Valley, so a lot of these high-tech companies, their problem is they say they can't get enough workers that they need. They can't get those high-skilled visas, and they can't get enough of them. You know, folks come to this country from other countries. They go to U.S. universities. They get a degree in engineering and computer science, and because of our immigration laws, they have to go back, get in line, and try to get one of these high-skill visas. So that's where you see folks like Zuckerberg getting in. That's also, you know, if another example is a lot of the law enforcement folks. I mean, it's traditionally thought of as, you know, if you're thinking law and order, if you're thinking of trying to lock down that border, you would think that most police officers and sheriffs would be against this kind of immigration reform. And there are, I've spoken to tons of them that are very much against it because to some degree it rewards bad behavior. It might encourage future waves of illegal immigration. But at the same time, you're hearing from a lot of them saying that if we fix the immigration system now, that illegal immigration would no longer be as much of an issue. So you're seeing these groups that traditionally don't get together. Usually you don't see the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the AFL-CIO getting together behind a bill. So those are a lot of the strange sort of bedfellows that we see kind of coming together behind this bill.
So Galen Carey with the National Evangelical Association. Does it make you at all uncomfortable to be allied with any of these people? Or since you're all interested in the same thing, are you able to find common ground?
Well, what's interesting is to see how many people from across the political spectrum and from different sectors of society are converging on this idea of immigration reform. So our part is to project a moral voice and to say what we think as church people needs to be done. But we are grateful that many people from many walks of life are also joining in the same call.
Do you also have a good number of people who are immigrants that you would like to recruit to the evangelical movement?
Well, yes, indeed. Many of the immigrants who come to the U.S. are already evangelicals, and others come to join our churches after they're here. So even immigrants are now a very important part of our membership. We've come to know them personally, and that's another reason that we care so much about this issue.
Galen Carey again with the National Evangelical Association. Mark Krikorian is executive director of the Center for Immigration Studies. That's a Washington think tank that favors stricter immigration control. Good to have you on our program.
Glad to be here, Warren.
What do you say about the prospects for the passage of this new bill that now has a couple of Republicans on it? That makes it bipartisan, and there may be enough others that, according to Alan Gomez, that the leadership will have to let it come to the floor.
Well, it's not going to happen. I don't think so anyway. I mean, this is it's kind of interesting that Congressman Denham from he's from Modesto, I think, from the valley somewhere.
The San Joaquin Valley in California.
Right. He backed this bill just as the main sponsor of it in the Senate, Marco Rubio, has come out and basically denounced his own legislation and said that under no circumstances should the House negotiate with the Senate to pass the bill that he sponsored, that instead the House should pass only targeted immigration measures addressing specific problems and should not negotiate with the Senate unless the Senate passes comparable targeted bills dealing with specific problems, which the Senate, Harry Reid in the Senate, has said is out of the question and he won't do. So, in other words, my point is, in a sense, the music stopped. A couple of Republicans who were backing in the House, backing this comprehensive 1,000-page bill approach, are left out in the cold because it seems to me at this point, you know, the game is over. I mean, Rubio has denounced the Schumer-Rubio bill, so I just think it's at this point, you know, this whole effort today in Washington with the Chamber of Commerce and the unions and all the other big institutions trying to revive the prospects of an amnesty And remember, the bill also doubles legal immigration. It's, you know, it's just not going to happen.
Galen Carey, back to you with the National Evangelical Association. What about that term amnesty?
Well, of course, what we like to point out is that the current situation is de facto amnesty because we have people here and we are not doing anything to effectively make our system work. What we're calling for is a plan in which people would acknowledge that they had done something wrong and they would pay appropriate penalties and they would get themselves right with the law. And most of the people that we know are people who are law-abiding in other ways and they want to get themselves right with the law. So by paying fines, penalties, waiting, going to the back of the line, that's not amnesty in any dictionary that I've seen.
And Mr. Kerkorian, what do you say to that?
I mean, this is kind of a sterile debate at this point. In the immigration field, amnesty means the illegal immigrant gets to stay. That's all it means. There's a whole academic literature of comparative amnesties between, you know, the United States and the United Arab Emirates and Malaysia and Spain. You know, this is a word game that the other side decided to play because they did focus groups. And there's actually been news coverage of this. They did focus groups, and they found that people really hate the word amnesty, so they came up with a new word. I mean, the basic, I don't care what you call it. Call it a banana if you want. The illegal immigrant gets to stay. And the reason, that actually I'd have to say the chief reason people resist this is that no one anywhere believes that the federal government, especially the Obama administration, will actually enforce the new immigration rules any better than the old ones. So that the Congressional Budget Office itself has estimated that 10 years from now, we're still going to have 7 million illegal immigrants. It solves nothing. That's the problem.
Let me introduce Frank Sherry. He's founder and executive director of America's Voice, which supports a broad immigration reform. Mr. Sherry, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me, Warren.
What about all those Republicans, if that's what we're talking about here, and that's where the conservative group is focused at the moment, who say, as does Mark Kerkorian, that what we've got to do first is really toughen the borders, really enforce the illegal entry issue, and whatever happens in Congress, the Obama administration will never do that. Consequently, you'll never get enough Republicans to go for it.
Well, we've had an enforcement-first approach for the last 25 years, and you see what results it's brought. Look, the idea of a comprehensive approach is you combine sustained border security with a mandatory employment verification system, which makes it harder for people here without papers to get jobs. Combine that with a path to legal status and eventual citizenship option for the 11 million undocumented immigrants who are not engaged in criminal activity, and then make sure you modernize our legal immigration system so that in the future people have an incentive to come legally and on airplanes and with proper vetting and with labor rights rather than cross the border with a smuggler where they're subject to exploitation once a year. So the idea is to put these together in a way where we have both more control and immigration that serves our economic and moral interests. So this is an idea as time has come. There's you know, some folks in the House Republican Party who are fighting it to the death. Mr. Kerkorian is part of that team. But I think we've won the argument. The question is whether House Republicans will act in their self-interest and pass a bill that could get into a negotiation with the Senate bill.
Okay, we're going to continue this conversation after we take a very brief break. I want to thank Alan Gomez of USA Today for being with us. We will continue with our current guest to add one more when we come back on our talking point later. We'll hear about U.S. troops in pursuit of the Lord's Resistance Army in Congo. It is a little-known mission with 100 American troops that we'll hear all about from a very interesting observer who went to Congo to report on it. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
Orman Olney back with To The Point. Talking today about immigration reform with 500 or 600 people, business leaders, law enforcement leaders, and evangelical leaders as well, on Capitol Hill today, trying to get Republicans to support immigration reform. We've heard from Galen Carey of the National Evangelical Association, who says he thinks they have a chance. We've heard from Mark Krikorian, who is for stricter immigration control, who says they don't have a chance. Frank Cherry with America's Voice, who supports broad immigration reform, says, well, maybe there is a chance after all. Ruben Navarrete is a CNN contributor, a nationally syndicated columnist with the Washington Post Writers Group. He joins us now. It's good to have you on our show.
Warren, good to be back with you.
Do you think that this 500 or 600 member lobbying group is going to be able to turn around enough Republicans that the leadership of the House will, in fact, allow votes on some of the bills that are being proposed?
No, I don't, because the question's upside down. The narrative coming out of Washington and New York is that pretty much the Republicans are to blame. If you just fix the Republican end of the problem, get more Republicans to support immigration reform, the whole thing will come down lickety-split. That's wrong. This is a bipartisan failure. Both political parties have an interest in keeping immigration reform way off the burner, not dealing with it. Neither political party, despite their rhetoric, wants to fix this problem. And so as we talk more and more about what it will take to get Republicans on board, we miss the donkey in the room, not the elephant in the room. The donkey in the room is the fact that there are many Democrats, Southern Democrats, conservative blue dog Democrats, Democrats from union states in the Midwest that do not want immigration reform. And so you can get all the Republicans you want on board, but there'll be enough Democratic defections in the long run to make sure nothing gets done.
Will the Democrats pass it in the Senate?
Democrats passed in the Senate thanks to something called a border surge amendment written by two Republican senators to get on board many other Republican senators, because had you not done that, you wouldn't have had enough Democratic support to get it through because of those Democratic defectors I talked about. And so the border surge amendment ended up taking a somewhat decent bill, I would say, a bill that I supported, and turn into something I couldn't support. Doubles the number of Border Patrolmen from 20,000 to 40,000. How can anybody on the left support that? The idea of 700 more miles of border fencing. So, yes, if you look at the big headline is the Senate bill passed. The important thing to do is read the fine print. It passed thanks to Republican support because it produced a very heavy-handed, draconian bill that no liberal should be supporting.
So you're saying the Southern Democrats are against it and the Union State Democrats are against it. Why are the Southern Democrats against it?
The Southern Democrats are against it because when you get to the Southern states, the big dividing line is not blue and red. It's brown and white and black and white to some degree. And Latinos don't fit well into that black-white paradigm in some of these Southern cities. Both blacks and whites are united in their concern that Latinos are, one, taking jobs from working-class folks and also changing the complexion. They don't want Birmingham to come into Little Mexico. They like Birmingham the way it is. And so there's that demographic anxiety that you see at work. And then in the Midwest with the union members, it's simple. They are afraid because immigrants outwork union members. They work harder. They tend to have a better work ethic. And the guy up in Wisconsin collecting two pensions because he belongs to, you know, AFL-CIO, you know, Chapter 142 or whatever, he collects two pensions. He doesn't want to work any harder to compete with these Mexican immigrants. He just doesn't keep them out.
Ruben Navarrete, again, CNN contributor with the Washington Post Writers Group. Frank Cherry, back to you with the director of America's Voice. What do you say to that analysis of legislation that you support?
I feel like 2007 is calling and asking Ruben to bring his analysis back then. It might have been true in the past. Certainly in 2007, AFL-CIO opposed an immigration reform bill that we supported, and there were many Southern Democrats who voted against the bill, but the facts are the facts. In 2013, every single Democratic senator voted for comprehensive immigration reform. In the House today, of 201 Democrats, 187 are co-sponsors of a bill that is based on the Senate bill. It actually takes away the border surge amendment that Ruben finds offensive, as do I. But in any case, I think the key dynamics in the past 5 or 6 years have been that Republicans have lurched to the right while Democrats have decided to lean into the issue. That's why you have Democrats prepared to vote for this. You have the AFL-CIO supportive of comprehensive immigration reform. They worked out an agreement with the Chamber of Commerce on a break-the-mold approach to workers coming in the future in the Senate deal. So you have, a united progressive front and a united Democratic front. And what you have is a divided Republican Party. Only a third of the Republican senators in the Senate voted for the immigration reform bill that is, I think, arguably center-right in its nature and its components. And the question now is whether the House Republicans are going to figure out a way to do what many of us believe is not only good policy, but is good politics for them. I mean, everyone knows that in 2012, the Republicans lost handily the Latino vote and the Asian vote and immigrant voters more generally. And the question is whether the Republican Party is going to rehabilitate their image with the fastest groups of new voters. One of the ways they can do it is deal with a defining and mobilizing issue for many of these new voters, which is immigration reform. So I think the Democrats are extending the Republicans a get-out-of-jail card. It's just not at all clear to me that the Republicans in the House are capable of organizing themselves to accept it.
Ruben Navarrete, that persuasive to you?
Not at all. I mean, Frank talked about 2007 as if it were 1957. 2007 was 6 years ago. In the realm of politics, that was 2 minutes ago. Some of the same members who were there, you're talking about people who in the House have been there for 10 or 20 or in some cases 30 years. So, yeah, they didn't make this miraculous turnabout in the last 6 years or so. What they've done is become much more crafty in the way that they try to fool Latinos in particular to think that somehow they are on their side. But you're never going to see people like Sherrod Brown, a Democrat from Ohio, come out and put any muscle behind immigration reform, despite the fact that he may vote for this or stay this, because he has to take care of his union buddies back home in Ohio. And if Frank were really interested in putting some pressure on Democrats to, quote, lean into this issue, he would be on President Obama's backside for deporting 2 million people, more often than he is, deporting 2 million people, most of them Latino, and through programs like Secure Community, which took the Arizona law basically and took it nationwide so that local cops are now enforcing immigration law nationwide at the behest of Barack Obama. So clearly, this is not as simple as black and white or blue and red. I mean, I take the position, having written about this issue for 25 years, both parties have performed horrible with regard to immigration. Neither party cares about Latinos. Neither party cares about immigrants. It's all about fooling people at this point.
Back to Mark Krikorian, again, with the Center for Immigration Studies, looking for stricter immigration controls. What about this border surge amendment that went into the Senate bill? Frank Sherry says he doesn't like it, and they've taken it out in the House. But do you think that is Ruben Navarrete correct that you couldn't get enough Democratic votes or Republican votes if you didn't have that in it with doubling the highway patrol and providing for more fencing?
Well, I mean, I don't know. They probably would have had enough Democrat votes, but the whole point of it was, I mean, he's correct, it was to rope in enough Republicans, or rather, let me put it this way, it was to give enough Republican senators who wanted to do what the corporate interests were telling them to do, which is to pass the bill, but wanted political cover. But I agree that it's that border surge amendment is completely phony. There's no way you can double the border patrol in a few years without, you know, admitting all kinds of people who shouldn't have been, you know, all kinds of cartel people will end up getting the border patrol, untrained people. And everybody knows it's not going to happen anyway. I mean, no one in the Senate who voted for that border surge amendment was under any illusions that it was actually going to happen. It's pure political theater, and everybody understands that it's just designed to get the bill to the president's desk, ultimately, and then all of that stuff will be ignored, just like, you know, all kinds of elements of Obamacare have been ignored, just like the administration has simply ignored certain elements of immigration law that it chooses not to enforce. You know, the idea that Frank had said that we've tried this enforcement-first approach for years and it hasn't worked, you know, is kind of laughable. I mean, we don't have mandatory verification of new hires, so that when you give your employer, new employer, your Social Security number, there's no mandate that he actually has to verify it to make sure you're not lying to him. Right now, we have only the most comically ineffective means of determining whether a foreign visitor has actually left when he's supposed to leave, and that matters because close to half of the illegal population came in legally and then just didn't leave. They didn't jump the border. We've put efforts in at the border. We still need probably a better infrastructure at the border because there are still fewer Border Patrol agents than there are police officers in the New York Police Department. But the value of the next dollar we spend on enforcement would be greater if it were spent on some kind of interior enforcement.
Okay. Let me go back to Frank Sherry on that, again, with America's Voice. What do you say to that? There's no mandate to verify employment. You can't tell when people fail to leave, even though they're supposed to. How can that be, then, Mr. Kerkorian says, that we're doing border control first?
Right. Well, listen, we are a part of comprehensive immigration reform. A key part of it is that we would have a mandatory employment verification system, the kind that Mr. Kerkorian advocates for. The part that he doesn't like is that it's coupled with the idea of legalizing the existing undocumented workforce, which totals approximately 8 million people. If you have mandatory employment verification on top of 8 million unauthorized workers, what you do is you make all the problems of illegal immigration much worse. You drive people further underground. Some people will leave, but most people will just accept worse conditions, poorer wages, and be more subject to exploitation, creating the exacerbating the problems of a two-tiered workforce in which scared workers are taken advantage of to the detriment of American workers, other immigrant workers, and decent employers who get undercut by unscrupulous employers. So we are prepared to accept an entry-exit system that works at our airports and seaports. We're prepared to accept an employment verification system that's mandatory, sustained border security. But what we're saying is you need to complement those with a rational and humane and realistic approach to 11 million people who are settled in America who aren't leaving. We, you know, Mitt Romney said, let's make life so miserable for them that they self-deport. That was litigated in the last election. It was rejected by the American people. The alternative is to give people a chance to earn legal status and an eventual shot at citizenship. And then you also have to combine that with a more flexible legal immigration system so that in the future you don't have people incentivized to try to scramble across the border to come here and work illegally. They're incentivized to wait in line and come legally and take jobs where they have labor rights and they don't undercut American workers. So that's the idea, is to put the pieces together so that the enforcement plus a functioning legal immigration system creates a level playing field where immigrants are legal, hiring is legal, people coming are legal, and you reduce illegal immigration to an irritant rather than the major way that workers come to America from Latin America.
Let me go back to Ben Navarette. You've said basically that it's Southern racism and union politics in the South and union politics in the northern part of the country, particularly the Midwest, that's holding this up. What would look like a good immigration reform bill to you?
Well, I think it's something that combines a lot of the elements we're talking about, but does it in such a way that you puts much more accountability on the immigrants themselves. I disagree with this idea that I think Mark mentioned it earlier, that somehow there are people out there who are categorically opposed to the idea of undocumented immigrants staying in the U.S. I don't think that's true at all. I think that what they're categorically opposed to is the idea that they would stay here without conditions. And there are folks from the far, far left who advocate an unconditional amnesty. And that's certainly not going to fly. I think most Americans feel that if you put the onus on the immigrant to make right with the law, get right with the law, to admit they did something wrong, to make reparations, to make it better, then I think people do go along with that. It's the answer, as with so much of our politics, really is in the middle. It's in the sensible center. It's not on the far left or far right. You know, I like both these guys. I know Mark and Frank. I've known them for years. We spent time together. I like them personally. They just happen to be wrong half the time, each of them, right? They feel the same way about me. We agree on some things. We disagree on other things. But at the end of the day, I'm thankful. I don't have to run an organization like these guys. I don't depend on fundraisings from foundations and other folks. I'm a syndicated columnist. I tell people what I think. I don't have to pay a staff. They have to keep the money coming in. And part of keeping the money coming in is playing to their base on the far right and the far left.
Let me go back to Galen Carey with the National Evangelical Association. Do you agree that there needs to be some sort of accountability on the part of the immigrants themselves, particularly those who have been here for some time without papers, in order to have a just resolution of this issue?
Well, yes, indeed. And no one wants to be accountable more than the immigrants themselves, who desperately want to make themselves right with the law. I think that's very well, that's very clear. I agree with Ruben that politicians on both sides of the aisle have dropped the ball, but I think our people are far ahead of that, and certainly in the evangelical community, we've seen a huge change in terms of greater support for immigration and wanting to give immigrants the opportunity to do the right thing. They want to do it, and we just need to make it possible.
I understand that there has been an organized prayer movement on behalf of immigration reform. Are you telling Republican Congress members that you might not support them next year in the midterm elections if, in fact, they don't support immigration reform?
What we're telling members of Congress in both parties is that we will support them when they do the right thing in immigration. We tell them we're praying for them. We realize this is not easy. So we have more than 187,000 people who've committed to be prayer partners for reform. And those people pray that our leaders will have courage and that they will do the right thing. And then they'll find that they get the support that they need.
Frank Sherry with America's Voice, do you think that there are Republicans who are really worried about the growth of the Latino vote and might vote for that reason?
Well, I think you're seeing evidence of it now. I mean, the first Republican to co-sponsor the bill that's based on bipartisan policy but introduced by Democrats in the House is Jeff Denham, as we've been talking about, from California. There's a number of Californians. I mean, you all know from the fact that California went from a state that used to reliably vote for Republicans as governors to a state that's true blue. And one of the main reasons is the rise of Latino and Asian voters who have transformed the state politically, in part in reaction to the lurch to the right by Pete Wilson and the GOP in the state. And so I think you're going to see more and more Republicans who are members of Congress in California moving in a different direction. Daryl Issa, a very conservative member from Southern California, is introducing a bill to give legal status to people in the country without papers. The same is true for members of Congress in Illinois, Colorado, Nevada, Texas, Florida, New York, states where the demographic change are proceeding at an accelerated pace, and districts are literally changing underneath the members of Congress who are mostly in bleached and gerrymandered districts where Latino and Asian immigrant voters aren't a big factor, but an increasing number are indeed. We've documented that there's 10 races that could turn on Latino votes alone in the 2014 midterm.
Very quickly, we, of course, broadcast out of California, although we're a national program. Mark Krikorian, we have 30 seconds left. Elena Ross Layden in Florida has also another Republican that's now on this bill. How concerned are you that Republicans who are facing Latino voters in the next election are going to vote for immigration reform? 30 seconds.
Not very, because the key issue is this. No one trusts the promises of the pro-amnesty folks that the immigration laws will be enforced in the future. Everyone understands that if the Senate bill passes, the amnesty part will happen, the enforcement parts won't. Just like in 1986, that's why enforcement has to happen first and has to be proven. The political class has to prove with actions that it's not lying this time. That's the problem.
All right. The beat goes on with regard to immigration. Mark Krikorian with the Center for Immigration Studies, Frank Sherry, Director of America's Vote, Ruben Navarrete, again with CNN and the Washington Post Writers Group, Galen Carey with the National Evangelical Association, our first guest, Alan Gomez of USA Today. Thank you all. A video called Kony 2012, released last year by a group called Invisible Children, was viewed some 88 million times in just its first month. The activist behind it helped secure a little-known commitment of 100 American Special Forces to capture or kill an African warlord who's no threat at all to the United States, but who kidnaps children and trains them to terrorize local villages. We'll hear about one of those American missions in a moment on To the Point.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more, all in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
We're on Alni, back with today's Talking Point. In the Washington Post, Rajiv Chandrasekaran describes a 15-hour trek in a rainstorm through suffocating jungle in Congo. It happened last month, and it was the first time American Special Operations advisors actually provided field support in the hunt for Joseph Kony, who leads the Lord's Resistance Army. Rajiv Chandrasekaran is senior correspondent and associate editor of The Washington Post. It's always good to have you on our program.
Good to talk to you, Warren.
Describe this mission through the jungle. It sounds like something out of Joseph Conrad.
Well, these are arduous missions out there. It's a triple canopy jungle with very tall elephant grass. It's not just the flora to worry about there, but the troops that were making the trek to Kony's camp had to contend with crocodiles lurking through the swampland. There was a panther off in the distance, and there was some worry that they might get trampled on by a herd of elephants. Quite a different set of worries than your usual combat patrol in Afghanistan, which worries about roadside bombs. But the perils aside, they were on this remarkable mission to try to raid one of Joseph Kony's camps in the Democratic Republic of Congo, which unfortunately they found to be empty when they got there.
There were other significant things about this, it seems to me, and things that have developed rather quickly, having to do with the willingness of various African countries to all get involved in this.
Yes. You know, Kony has presented something of a threat to a number of countries in Central Africa in the past, to Uganda, to the Congo, as well as to the lawless Central African Republic. At this stage, however, he's a bit of a spent force. He only has a couple of hundred fighters under his command, and he's pretty much gone to ground. He's off hiding, while he and his henchmen committed some unspeakable atrocities in recent years, killing villagers, kidnapping children, and turning them into soldiers, as you noted. They aren't doing much of that anymore. They're in hiding. Yet the hunt for them goes on, and now obviously supported by the U.S. military, which is providing some critical training and intelligence and transportation support to some of these African armies that are pursuing Kony. And for the Americans, this is all in the name of both regional stability as well as trying to build closer relations with some of these countries.
So it really has nothing to do with American security then. It's a sort of diplomatic outreach?
Yes. I mean, Kony poses no threat to American interests. In fact, he doesn't even really pose an existential threat to any of the African nations in which his forces are operating in or are close to. This is more about an American assistance campaign that was driven in part by political pressure back in the United States, the result of some very savvy work done by activist groups, including Invisible Children, which was behind the Kony 2012 video that went viral. Their efforts led to legislation in Congress that instructed the administration to take a more active role in supporting these African militaries that were trying to get Kony. The White House decided to interpret that legislation to allow the use of U.S. combat advisors, and so they were deployed there 2 years ago. We're now in our third year of this mission. There's still 100 U.S. Special Operations troops there. They're focused on training. I'll be very clear. They're not out there leading these missions. They're not doing the stuff themselves. But they're out there in the jungle, walking side by side in some cases with these African forces as they try to hunt down Kony, who, as one commander put it to me, is not just like a needle in a haystack, but like a needle in 20 haystacks. He and his men are hiding out in a stretch of jungle about the size of the state of Texas.
You can't find them with drones and satellites?
Well, it's triple canopy jungle, Warren. You can't really peer through that thick jungle cover. Now, they are using drones with some infrared sensors to try, but really it comes down to on-the-ground intelligence. Reports from the few people who defect from his organization, trying to use their information to pinpoint his location, trying to get some reports from local villagers. And when they go off and raid these camps, the way they're set up, there's plenty of kind of lookout points for some of the members of Kony's group, so they can take off into the jungle. So now the Americans and the African forces have been joined by Belgian Malinois tracking dogs. What's interesting here, Warren, is that these dog teams are being funded by two American philanthropists. This isn't the U.S. military sending in its dogs, but you now have some rich Americans who have decided to get into this by writing checks to pay for these dogs.
Has President Obama taken a personal interest in this?
Well, he certainly has. When the Kony 2012 video came out a couple of days later, as it was going viral, his deputy national security advisor went up to inform him about it. And when that advisor started to talk about it, Obama cut him off and said, I already know about that. Malia, his daughter, talked about it over dinner last night, he told his aide. And so that video, which was very popular among junior high school and high schoolers as well as college students, was also viewed by at least one of Obama's daughters and led to a White House familial discussion. Now, there's no evidence. In fact, that video came out after the president's decision to send troops. But since then, the president, you know, has reaffirmed his support for this mission. And what's also interesting here, Warren, is that it has bipartisan support on Capitol Hill. And back in August, 75 members of Congress wrote the president a letter saying, don't let up on the hunt for Coney. I then took those names and I ran it through a tool that we have on our website that identifies where every member of Congress stood on the debate about whether to launch an airstrike against Syria for its use of chemical weapons. And I found that only 8 of those 75 members of Congress that were urging Obama in August to stay the course on the Coney hunt, a month later in September, only 8 of them had made statements supporting the president's decision or the president's a desire at that point to engage in a military strike on Syria.
Could this be a template, this strategy, for addressing other places, other problems in other parts of the world, and including something you mentioned in passing, which is the effort to get defections?
Well, U.S. military officials certainly think so. As we wind down the war in Afghanistan and look to trying to address threats across the globe, but to do so in a smaller, more sustainable way, they're looking to this effort to really draw some key lessons, an effort that involves, instead of the Americans doing it themselves, the Americans building capacity among partner nations, providing them important enablers, as the military would call it, intelligence, at times airlift with helicopters, food and fuel, things that some of these militaries may sometimes lack, but really helping to train them to get out in front and take action themselves.
Rajiv Chandrasekaran with The Washington Post, author of Little America, The War Within the War for Afghanistan. As always, great to talk with you.
Pleasure to talk to you, Warren.
I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.